RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
There can be few designers who can boast that work they created over half a century ago is still in everyday use. And by that I mean every moment of every day. My guest today can justly make that claim. Margaret Calvert, along with her late business partner Jock Kinnear, created the signage strategy for the British Transport National Road Network, and it is as effective today as when it was introduced back in the 1960s. The disarmingly simple, clear design program went on to inspire road networks around the world. For Margaret Calvert, work has to have a purpose, a function, and it must function well. As a regular user of our motorways, I can confirm that it works extremely well. Our conversation took place at Margaret's North London home and studio, where I started by asking her about her early life in South Africa. Childhood. I can already tell, listening to your voice, you know, those little telltale South African vowel sounds, which are still very evident, considering you came here when you were 15. So I knew you were born in Durban, in South Africa, and you were schooled in Pretoria. Set the scene of what it was like as a young girl in South Africa.
I was born in a little place called Malvern, just outside Durban. I don't know whether I was born in the house or in the nursing home, or I just don't. There's certain facts about my life that I actually don't know because I wasn't curious enough to ask my mother. I'm very sorry about that. So I'm now sort of doing a lot of research into her life and my father's so that I can put it all together. Mm-hmm. Because they both came from this country originally, of course. And I think when my mother was a young woman, she actually went to Middlesex. It was Hornsey then, to do art. Oh. And then she thought this wasn't for her, really. And so she went and did nursing. But by then, she'd met my father in South Africa. Because women of that age kept going over to South Africa for a good time on boats and that. So I have got family that went over to South Africa. A rumour has it, or not rumour, that one grandparent took the first printing press or something. I've got to check that out, you see. I keep getting these little bits of information, but I've not put them together. Anyway, so she married my father, whose family came from Dorset, and because I remember my grandmother, her wonderful accent, quite extraordinary. The sad bit is that was I was born in 1936, as you know, and of course the war started in 39. So I had an idyllic childhood up to the age of 5, mm-hmm. and great memories of my father playing with him and all of that.
What did he do?
Well, I've got photographs of him in his army, in his uniform, because I think he was training to be an accountant who was very good at algebra and mathematics and all of that. He joined the Royal South Africa, and he was just about to get his commission to go up north. And very sadly, he, with his best friend, on Saturday, asked permission to go to the cinema. They went to the cinema, they had an accident, and he got killed. So that completely changed everything. And so my mother had to obviously earn money. So she went and did some private nursing, because she was a theatre sister by then. And we were put, my sister, who's 3 years older than me, we were put in a home, a horrible home, for a year. And then let the house, my sister stayed there with two school mistresses. And then she took me up to a job that she got in a place called Kilnerton, just outside Pretoria, in the veld. Quite wild, but it was a Methodist educational establishment for girls. Well, they're also very young children as well. And it was an amazing place. We stayed in this big hostel. It was for, I always call them Africans. I'm not comfortable with the terms black and white for people. Sure. And these people like Nelson Mandela, and that mm-hmm. was a teacher training college of sorts, an educational establishment with both black and white teachers. Mm-hmm. And these students would come from all over Africa, a lot from Rhodesia, which it was then, and Mozambique and Tanganyika or something. It was called Namibia. I think I'm going to get that wrong, so mm-hmm. we'll cut that out. Mm-hmm. And my mother ran the hostel, the girls' hostel, and then the other end of the plantation was the boys' hostel, and there were about five, and there was a church on the top of a koppie, So we all had to go to church, march up the hill and that, and all that was all right. I didn't bother about the religious bit. Mm. But it was just, I was completely free while my mother ran the place. The students adored her and run by the Methodists. And so, you know, there were black and white teachers. And we were just like five on Treasure Island, Enid Blyton type children messing about on our bikes. And I can remember one time that just learning to ride a bicycle. My sister got a new one. I got a secondhand one that was always breaking down. And I was just, I couldn't get on and I couldn't get off. So I was helped to get on, but trying to get off was very difficult. So I was going not quite down a hill, shouting, stop me, really, really loud. And several girls came rushing over, my friends, and they grabbed this bicycle to stop me. Now, that's a very brave thing to do.
Yes.
But after that, I was teased to death, because whenever they saw me, they'd shout, stop me, stop me. So that's a good memory. But the bad thing is, and I have to say this, I went back with Jock on our way to Australia to design the signs for their two new airports in Sydney and Melbourne. Mm. And the people I stayed with, Jock went down to the Cape to do some business, drove me round Kilnerton, as it was called, and it was it had completely been wiped out and declared a white zone only. And they were all full of, sorry, it's getting a bit heavy, all full of little bungalows, horrible little bungalows. So I just didn't feel I belonged in the same way.
Yeah.
So
that was, and then sometimes we went it's on. Not good to go back.
But I'm back there in my mind.
Sure.
My mother, she then got a job in Pretoria Girls High, which was both a boarding school and a day school. Mm-hmm. And she was the housemistress of one of the colleges there. And she was at the housemistress in North Lodge. I was a boarder with my sister in South Lodge. I was there for about a year and a half, 2 years. And then by then, the nationalist government got in. Segregation was even worse, apartheid. And she said, it's time to come back to England, to her family. So she made that decision.
Yes.
My sister had finished her education. I was in the middle of mine. And the thing about education there is, at that particular school, that you had to speak Afrikaans. They changed the language. So if you'd been taught in geography, it was all done in Afrikaans 1 year. Then the next year, it was history, it changed to Afrikaans. And the next year, it would change to math. And that was appalling, because I just was not very good at that language at all. But I had some very good Afrikaans friends.
Afrikaans is sort of Dutch derivative.
That's right, yes.
Very
sort of low Dutch, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was a bit of segregation between the Dutch and the Afrikaans people and the white people.
So your mother packed up.
So
and
she
you,
packed
with
up.
With your sister, you came back.
Yes,
here.
And with one stray dog, came back on the Athlone Castle, arrived in Southampton. There were all my relatives from farming to meet us. It was early January, and it had just been snowing, and I thought, I fell in love with the country immediately.
Well, you did, really?
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you, because it was only 4 years after the war.
Well, that's right.
Obviously, if you'd arrived in London, it would have probably been a different matter, because it would have been pretty depressing.
Well,
although Southampton, I think, got probably...
Well, you see, the thing is, it wasn't depressing. I don't know why, it just wasn't. London was wet and grey, and these enormous bomb sites, and of course we were told the history of it, and of course a lot of my relatives, some were killed in both the first and the second, and some weren't, but you kept hearing these stories, and they were always somehow positive about how they coped with food.
Yes, yes.
And of course, there were rations then.
Yes.
Now, to have a ration book, fantastic. Yes. Because, you know, to go to the little village shop in Ascot, Wychford, near Ascot, with two T's in Warwickshire, was wonderful, because the little bell would go, you'd go in, and there were all these sweets. And we never had them in South Africa to the same extent. They were all under the counter because of the war.
Right.
So I just ate sweets galore. I mean,
oh
you had masses on your rations. And, of course, my teeth, that affected my teeth. And my uncle was a dentist, and he thought it was absolutely disgraceful.
Yes.
So he blamed my mother anyway.
So you were 15 when you came here?
I was 14.
14.
Yes, I had, yes. I'm sure I was 14, yeah.
So you're off to school still here.
Right. So that's another thing. I had to go to school.
Yes.
Now, I just switched off everything. I never had a thought about, I wasn't asked any, about anything. I just left it to whatever happened. I was just pleased to be away from South Africa. And the, yeah, exactly. Mm. I mean, art, we had always, I had a wonderful art master at my primary school in Hatfield. All we did was art and hear stories. He was Scottish, a bit mad as well. And then a wonderful art mistress at Toria Girls High. So it was always art. And sport.
So, would you say you were more pulled towards the arts and academic subjects, or were you an all-rounder?
No.
So you were a natural creative,
if you like.
Well, drawing.
I loved drawing because he just encouraged not us; it was me to draw. So yeah. I just drew all the time. Anything he said, draw anything, egg cup.
Yeah.
So I was quite alone in that respect because you know.
So how did that work when you came over to the UK?
Right.
Did you find another teacher that was?
I did, but I was not. I didn't go to school for a year while they found a school for me, and then I had to have. I went for an entrance. It was St Paul's Girls' School in Brook Green.
Yes.
And I felt like a real fish out of water because my accent was very, very strong.
Strong, yes.
Then.
Yes.
And they spoke in this sort of...
Yes, you know, RP.
That's
probably.
Right, yes. And so I found it very difficult to adapt. So it was just sport, but luckily again... Well, I passed the entrance exam the second time. I failed the first. Winnie Passmore, Victor Passmore's sister, she was the art mistress at St Paul's.
Oh.
So I did art, a lot of that, both at, well, at A level as well. So I stayed on an extra year and I did it in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And then what to do, and she mentioned Chelsea. Otherwise, I knew nothing about art schools or college. I had no idea. I was very completely ignorant of everything in that respect.
Sure.
And so I went along and had a wonderful interview by Brian Robb, who was head of illustration mm-hmm. at Chelsea. Absolutely wonderful and relaxed. My mother came to the interview as well, and so I was accepted, and that's where it all started.
And that was
started.
A four-year course, was it?
It was,
not, which
yes.
is quite a long time, isn't it? Different it, sort of setup then, I should think.
I thought it was a wonderful setup, really, compared... Well, I have to be careful here, actually, because I didn't know how it would all end up. Didn't know what career I would choose.
No.
But you had 2 years fine art intermediate course... So that was a lot of life drawing by these wonderful artists and people like Leonard Rosmond and Fred Brill. And I can remember just being in this room, complete silence, but all you heard were the comments from the tutor. Very, very strong comments, quite upsetting sometimes, I would have thought. Mm. And you just hung on to every word. And they would do wonderful little drawings in the corner of your half-imperial sheet mm-hmm. to explain a little fact
sure.
or something. And it was really about learning to look and think and coordinate everything. So I loved all of that.
Yeah.
I just...
No, I think a little later on, Jock Kinnear was a visiting tutor.
Because I chose... You could either do fine art, which was sculpture and painting, or you could do printmaking... and illustration. There was no graphic design. So I chose, for the final two years, I chose illustration and printmaking.
Yeah.
And very wisely, Brian Robb, together with the marvellous principal at that time, invited a designer, a proper designer, graphic designer, to come in to give illustration students a sort of awareness of what graphic design was. And Hans Schlager was actually there when I moved into that particular year. I mean, we were a very small group. There were only about a dozen of us at the most. And Hans was wonderful. The only problem was I didn't understand a word he was saying. Very intellectual approach.
Sure.
And quite, although he was very much the artist, designer, all-rounder, he was seemed to be focused towards advertising in terms of how he explained things. And there were a few students there that really were very focused in wanting to go in that direction, and the others were lined up for going to the Royal College of Art. So I was never going to go that in either of those directions. So anyway, then Hans left, and then his assistant came, and that was no good. And then they got Jock in. Now, Jock had been an associate with Design Research Unit, as you know all of that, because this is your time as well. No, not quite. You're younger than me.
But maybe the listeners don't know, so it would...
So he wanted to start, having done his, what know.
I mean, I think we should explain that at this period, yeah, which is right, in the 50s,
okay, yeah,
graphic design was really a new innovation. It was called commercial art.
That's absolutely right.
And so there were a few groups that were obviously, you know, inspired by the modernists and what was going on in Switzerland and Germany, and graphic design would be taken seriously.
And I think, you know all of this, of course. I mean, Dick Guyot, who was professor at the Royal College of Art, I mean, he's credited with, well, at least coming up with the term graphic design instead of publicity design all of that.
Yes.
And then others will say it came from New York or somewhere. So one doesn't know. It probably something that happened.
I think there's a lot of...
Yes.
One can look at it from both sides of the coin. I think
there's a lot
of excitement going on at the time.
Oh, amazing excitement. And the 50s get written about enough. It was an amazing time.
You went on, I just want to push on a bit, Central.
In a way I did, because when I started with Jock, right? I mean, there's a big story about how I did start with Jock, actually, because he just offered me a job when I was... What the hell do I do? I can't go to... Usually he did a teacher training course on top of your... So that would have been 5 years. And no way could I teach and stand in front of secondary modern children. So he offered me this job because he just got this... Being asked by the architects, York, Rosenberg and Mardell, who were designing the new Gatwick Airport. They needed the signs and all of that to be done. So because he was one of their neighbours, and so he was asked if... he'd like to do it, and he said we'd never signed an airport before, but of course you say yes. And so that was his first big job after setting up in Old Barrack Yard, having left Design Research Unit. And then he needed some help, so he asked me, and then suddenly it was all off, because either it wasn't going to happen, or he got cold feet, or whatever, and, you know, my aspirations just plummeted. And then... he used to do exhibitions at Wembley for the Milk Marketing Board. They were beautiful exhibitions because he wanted to be an architect more than a graphic designer. And coming back from Chelsea, because it was just sort of winding up, I bumped into him on Ealing Broadway Station, and it was all on again. And so anyway, so I started almost the next day.
And so you were involved with the creation of the typography, the type itself.
Well, yeah, okay, let me just finish how that, because the very important part...
Yeah.
He said, well, you need to brush up your typography. That was his words. Well, I hadn't got any typography to brush up. Hadn't been taught properly at Chelsea. I mean, there was just... I mean, Jock would set us something to do with Battersea Funfair or something, to do a leaflet or whatever. And I took everything very seriously, and I started coming in early, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he just thought I was somebody that was taking things seriously, which I was. So I did go to the Central in that respect, but they were evening classes run by Colin Forbes or Fletcher Forbes. And George Dorby of BDMW, you know,
I do.
Was teaching then. And he was he opened my eyes completely.
Well, Central at that time was a real hothouse.
It was, wasn't it?
And so many people that went from Central... eventually onto the Royal College, but were very disappointed what they found at the Royal College. You know,
I can believe it.
Because it was like going back into Victorian.
Absolutely. And, you know all those wonderful illustrators.
You brushed up on your typography.
I did. And then, took to it like
so,
I loved it.
So how long did you stay there for?
Oh, well, I suppose the evening classes probably just lasted a couple of terms.
Right.
No more. You don't need teaching. Somebody has to just... show you something.
Yeah.
You're looking over your shoulder what other students are doing. I used to think, and it was a lot of drawing type, small, 8-point. So I used to think, oh, that's typography.
That's an interesting point you make, because
I did that.
Briefly going back to the Royal College, because so many of the people there were disappointed with what they found, they would
during Alan Fletcher's time.
That's right. And Raymond Hawkey.
Absolutely. And
Len Dayton. And
that
whole
wonderful woman at DRU, whose name I can't remember.
They were inspired by one another, which is the point you
were
making.
That's right,
rather than the tutors who were just going on with the same
old,
let's use Egyptian, whatever.
That's right, Egyptian, whatever.
That's
a good term.
Back to
describe the graphics.
So you then go back and you feel more equipped typographically.
Yes. But, of course, I was never a student there.
No. I mean, back to Jock.
Oh, yes. And then, absolutely.
You felt a lot more confident,
yes. Oh,
presumably.
Completely. Yes. I mean, again, just working on Gatwick,
yes.
It was just like this, two of us across a table.
Yeah.
And I did all the humble things, if you could call them humble, like making coffee, but not always, because if I was busier than Jock, he would make the coffee.
Good.
But backwards and forwards across the park, Hyde Park, yeah. To photographers called Frank Slinger, and we got these enormous stats of full-sized signs. And Jock was working on a new letter form,
yes.
When I joined him.
Yeah.
And it was at that stage that I just had my opinion about certain things, and we shared discussions and arguments, and the letter form changed slightly.
Mm-hmm.
But what we ended up with was actually fairly crude, to put it bluntly.
Really?
So we were always having a second chance.
Yes.
But how... I know this will probably answer one of your questions that are coming, but it's a series of coincidences that things happen. And as a result of Gatwick, Colin Anders comes. He was actually the provost at the Royal College of Art, but I didn't know that until a lot later. But he was the chairman of the P&O Orient line, and he, because of Gatwick, he asked Jock to design this labelling system for all the P&O Orient line ocean liners with a set of adhesive labels.
Yeah.
Jock did the main set, which were swing labels. We worked on them together, but the togetherness was really me talking about colour and doing the artwork.
Right.
But they were Jock's concept and Jock's design and Jock's job. And so that's where I learnt, you know, all the skills of how to sort of do laborious artwork. I did do the adhesive labels, you see.
Yes.
And that was at a time when if you had an idea that, because there were just the two of us, that you thought about something, and then you say, oh, and then I would just quickly draw a little visual of something to do with the idea, which related to his tie-on labels, and he would just say, fantastic, great. Sometimes he didn't, but he would the next morning.
Yes.
Often he was right, so it was that kind of relationship, but the best idea won.
Oh, well,
winning
that's...
is not the right word. So, and the colours and all of that were to complement the more primary ones of Jock's. So that's when that was not quite my first job that I can claim as my own, but perhaps about the third.
Then, after the Gatwick job, I think that led on to the much bigger...
Yes, because of Gatwick, the labels, Sir Colin... Well, the road sign story, as everybody knows, a committee was set up to look at motorway signs.
The Anderson
committee, yeah. Yes, that's Colin Anderson's committee. He was the chairman, and he remembered Jock from... the Orient Line labels and Gatwick, and so Jock was invited to be the consultant, and so Hugh Casson was on this, well, the initial party to recommend. I don't think he was on the committee. So anyway, all that started to roll, and we then increased our number because we needed it. That was a period of 5 years the road signs took.
Yes, I mean, did it the dates seem to be, because I know that it's an anniversary year, but it doesn't seem to quite fit, because
it seemed to
start in 1957.
Well,
the actual
1958, more like, actually, but
and it continued.
It took a long time
well
to sort of get going
the
with the committee and the testing with the road research laboratory and committee meetings and all of that. And then, of course, once the motorways were done,
yes.
A wonderful civil servant, Usborne, it was his suggestion that if these are working so well on the motorways, why don't we look at adapting them to the all-purpose road? So a second committee was set up, the War Boys Committee, and Jock just, we just continued with that.
Did you just, were you working on other things once that got rolling?
A few other things,
dedicated
but
to that?
Mainly it was that,
I just
yes.
wondered whether
it was almost,
you got bored ever.
I never
ever got bored.
Never got bored.
Now, there is a job that I hope that you were responsible for.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I should burn this book.
On the road sign, yeah.
Well, this is not the road sign. I mean, I think the road signs have been so well documented.
Well, they have.
Maybe incorrectly here and there. That it's detracted from some other things that I personally love.
Absolutely.
So, for
example... Right there, yeah, especially now. Yeah.
I love the Rudman and Burkitt fishmongers. I remember seeing that way back in the 60s when I was first in design. Mm-hmm. And the reason I love it so much is that it is so, for that period, it must have been like something that arrived from outer space, because there's a photograph in this book of people passing by the front of a shop.
Yes.
And they look as if they're from the 1920s. There's a guy with a cloth cap, and there's a funny old pram, you know, the sort that the royal family still seem to use, one of those big prams with the huge wheels. Mm. And then behind is this very starkly simple, very graphic, lowercase lettering shop front with the lettering shifted to one side to give it a little bit of tension. And it's really lovely. And I know that it didn't last long.
It was a family business, L. Birkett and Company. And it had these shops in, I think it was Putney, and one marvellous one in Knightsbridge, right opposite Harrods, a beautiful sight. And he asked us to do it because he was so impressed by the motorway signs. And so when that job came in, and Birkett was just a small family company with these two shops, so it lasted until the family died. But anyway, so to do the vans, to have this wonderful client come in with so much enthusiasm, knowing he just wanted something different that represented the spirit of what was happening on the motorways. Mm. And then, of course, if you did anything with a van, you should avoid white, because white gets dirty. Mm. Now, the whole point about white with a fishmonger is that they have to keep it clean. So there weren't any white vans in London at that time. And then again, to have something big and clear that you could see from the distance or in traffic. And of course, so to me, the fish was the obvious answer. Mm. Partly because, again, we ate fish on Fridays. So it's not exactly a Christian symbol, but there is a connection there, I think. So to actually do that fish and the contribution of Jock was actually to make it more, human's not the right word, but to actually almost have a mouth form at the end. And I think that helps a lot. And the freeness of the actual brush stroke, that was done big. The real difficulty was to get it done well, because they weren't sort of there to take things that seriously.
So were they painted on the tracks, or were they some sort of transfer?
Can't remember.
I've only seen photographs.
Remember.
They look very good.
The vans were beautifully done.
Very beautiful.
And I think whoever did them took immense pride in doing them.
Yeah.
So then also the bags and the signs.
Yes, that's right. And the price list.
Which again, very simple, but I wasn't a graphic designer really. I mean, I've sort of kind of taught myself to do that, but because it's sort of logical, but it hasn't got a modern feel about. Well, it has sort of. Anyway, well, the bags are good. The bags are excellent. Yep. So there were just the site between the two shops. One was a purpley lettering, and the other one was sort of dark green.
Sort of an olive, a light
deep olive. Deep olive, yeah.
Yeah. So when you became a partner about this sort of time?
That was 1966.
Yeah.
And I think at that time we did have other senior designers there, because we took them on to help with all the road signs. The pressure there was immense. And
how many people would you say were working there at the time?
I think about half a dozen. So I just said I was doing so much of the design, I just said to Jock, it's time I was acknowledged.
Oh, so you took the initiative?
I think I did, actually. But Jock, bless him, just went with it. And, of course, I redesigned all the stationery and all of that to get that set up. And that's how that started.
One other thing, you're at Chelsea where you did mostly illustration, and I noticed
I got a drawing scholarship there, which helped.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because I can only find, again, it's very difficult looking through various books, but one example of your illustration, which is for The Golden Warrior, which is the opera cover for Schott's, the music publishers.
That's right, yes.
And it's only in black and white.
Yes.
And I have an imagination for what sort of colours it might have been in.
That's all in black and white, though, isn't it?
I'm afraid so. Yeah, yes. No colour at all.
The colour is the best part of it.
Yes, I was interested. Did you do a lot of illustration? Or was that a rarity? I did notice.
Well, isn't it funny? I don't call that illustration.
Well, it was an illustration. I mean, it was a very graphic form.
Very graphic, yes.
And it reminded me a little bit, I guess, of. Do you remember there was an artist at the time called Gaynor Chapman?
Used to do posters for
the Underground. Very blocky, slightly textural, graphic finish. Mm. It had that, much simpler, but it had that sort of feel. And I noticed a cover that you'd done for, I think, Ryman, and it had just two blocks of colour and an irregular oval.
Oh, right, you remember all
and
that?
And it reminded me of sort of William Scott, who was very, an artist, 20th century British artist.
I was just trying out things for myself. Yes. To just intuition. It's the feel of breaking away. I mean, I was never interested in book illustration. Although I had to do a bit of that at Chelsea, and I enjoyed it. Mm. But I've always just thought books should be read anyway.
I very much saw those drawings, just the few that I'd seen, as much more sort of graphic interpretations, which I found interesting, rather than traditional, drawing, with all that entails.
I mean, the illustrators right up to now, I mean, they are, when they're good, they are just so genius,
Yeah.
You've got to be totally focused on that. Well, and my interest was getting broadened in terms of identities and
of course.
Doing things big.
Of course, you've spent a lot of your life teaching.
Yes.
I mean, a huge part of your life. Probably longer than you were actually working with Jock. I mean, you were head of graphics from 1987 to 91.
That's right.
But you've been a lecturer part-time with the Royal College from 1966 to 2001.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
Well, I can easily divide my life up into chapters, and the RCA is a very big chapter.
Huge chapter.
Do you want to know how I got into teaching at the college or not?
Was it something you were aiming for, or did
Never.
It just accidentally
no,
come about? Somebody
no,
suggested
it,
you...
I think working with Jock on these big projects and that, just the two of us, I was quite lonely. Not lonely in a heavy sense, but it was becoming too narrow.
Sure.
I needed something more. Mm-hmm. And Jock was aware of this, because at that time he was head of graphic design at the Royal College of Art when Dick Guyot was the professor, and they didn't quite agree on certain things. And Brian Robb was running illustration then. Mm-hmm. And Misha Black of DRU was the professor of industrial design, as they called it. Mm-hmm. And Misha Black wanted the industrial design students to have some sort of idea about what typography was, because it related to what you put on a washing machine or a fridge or something. So he asked Jock, because they knew each other, because Jock got quite a bit of work from DRU when he started up, and he had enormous affection and respect for Misha Black. and so Jock's thinking about me. So he suggested me. So, and he came back, and I thought, oh God, no, I couldn't possibly teach at the RCA, despite not wanting to go there because of its Victoriana and all of that, I still thought it was, some place. And so, something comes up like that, you're offered a chance and you've got to take it. So I took it, and it was only for like an afternoon once a week. And these industrial design students, they took some of them on straight from school then, from the sixth form. Of course, they don't do that now. And Jock Kinnear's son, Ross Kinnear, was a student at that time. So anyway, I'd go in and I set this project to design the lettering for parking meters. And they were very, very clever boys. And, always with a student, I would just start talking and finding out what they were interested in. And they'd always show me these extraordinarily complex drawings, trying to, phase me out a bit. But I set them this project, and I have to say, they took it very seriously, more so than graphic designers wouldn't bother with a job like that anyway. So I enjoyed it, and we'd have these little group crits and things, and a few guilds and that, but they were always there. And so that's how I got into teaching. And then Dick Guyot said, oh, can't you do the same with the illustrators? Well, I didn't have the time to do any more than an hour a week. So I shut it down with the industrial designers. I then went to the illustrators, and people like Dan Fern were students then. Mm-hmm. And I set them a completely different project, of course. But they were brilliant. They really were. Did better typography than the designers. And then Dick said, why don't you do a day teaching on a more formal basis with the graphic designers? So that's what I did. And I did that for a very long time. But you see, one day a week is you're concentrating on your professional work as well. But when you're with the students, you have to put them first. So I got very, very committed to that. But I've never thought of myself as a teacher. particularly in typography, because I had to teach myself that. Mm. So, but I was then Herbert Spencer took over, and Herbert, you know, was a great friend and brilliant typographer and all of that. So, I mean, and then he offered me another day when Jock retired from, we were called Kinnear Calvert then, I think, because we sort of go up and down, everything goes up and down and ends. Sure. That was enough. So I was just doing 2 days then and working with Monotype on my typeface, which they decided to call Calvert, which was started as a face for a new town in France, St. Quentin-en-Yvelines, and they thought it was too English, so I used it for the Metro and the Tyne and Wear.
That's right.
And then Monotype said, oh, how about turning it into a typeface? Now, at that time, it was metal, and to actually just do a metal typeface, whew, that was climbing the Alps. Mm. Fantastic. But everything then changed, and it was so on flux.
So when you were... When you were putting that typeface together,
digital typeface,
Calvert,
yeah.
Was it hand-drawn?
Oh, absolutely!
It's all
yes.
by you.
Yes, you see a lot of that original. I've got the drawings of that. But the ones for the road signs, all those. Once you put something on film, you chuck the cardboard stuff away. And the maquettes. Sorry to go back to the road signs, but the maquettes were. Jock said, "Oh, you know, we're moving now. If anybody wants anything, go. It's up in the attic. This is an old barrack yard just off Knightsbridge. Go help yourself." So they found these maquettes. And they're now in Bride Library.
Oh, really?
So that's the story of them.
Okay.
But any original artwork, and that's in the tip at Hammersmith.
You, the relationship with the Royal College, does it still continue now? Mm. Or is it sort of just occasionally you might evolve with something?
Oh, I was invited by Sarah Bont to set a project. This was be about 3 years ago, something, right. to something I set up for students to do called Design Without Labels, with the idea that they'd work on them just for a week, not get sort of bogged down by a two-year project or whatever. And it was the idea was that you would approach it not as a graphic designer or typographer, but I would pose the project and they would come up with the answers. But the answers could be from any discipline. It was really just to get rid of the borders and to open their minds and have good discussions. So yeah. That really was well. And the first, I won't talk about the ones I did. Anyway, Sarah invited me back because she was running it then, but she's now left because I retired in 2001. Mm. And then having retired, it's like I've started a new life in terms of design. It's just like that, working with ex-students. Mm. So,
well, I know that, for example, your transport media has been redrawn.
That's right.
Which has been used for the gov.uk
yes.
for the website.
That's
and
right,
it's
yes.
pulled together all the government departments.
Yes.
That must have pleased you to see it.
Absolutely. But you see, I can't do these interviews because it's my whole life trying to.
Sure.
And it just takes too long to explain anything. But I'll have a go at that. But it's almost as if it had to happen. Mm. It's like I've gone full circle.
Well, I think because we now live in a digital age.
Yeah.
People are, and also as I'm sure when you were young, you young designers.
What do you mean when I was? Sorry, it's just a joke. I'm going to have some more water. We're still young in the head.
Oh yeah. What I was about to say was that being now in a digital age with a whole range of young designers who are discovering things for the first time, and I can understand the passion and excitement of young designers working with you, digitizing your own typefaces for a digital age and maybe with you working together, making those little tweaks that maybe you were not able to do at the time or that you can now see that it would be improved by. That's great. And I think, you know, what the beauty of that typeface is it's longevity.
Yes.
Great typefaces will
last.
Well,
you see, it was functional.
It's the functionality.
It really was,
and the legibility.
About, it wasn't about style. And the thing I keep saying to everybody is that face, let's call it lettering because it wasn't a face. It wasn't a typeface. It was specifically designed to be read as a light letterform on a dark background and a dark letterform on a light background.
Yes.
Now that is a different way of drawing as opposed to, actually it's quite similar, as opposed to a digital typeface.
Mm.
So I actually redrew Transport, not all of it, from that very crude sign up there.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see if I could get it back in my head. And I tried to improve certain things and making certain curves, minor adjustments, but basically drawing it by hand, and it's almost identical. So it's stamped. It's in my what's the word called that your
DNA.
Oh, thank you. Well, in my DNA. Working with Henrik.
Yeah.
He is amazing in terms of, well, I mean, he's so passionate about designing typefaces. Mm. We won't go on the whole story about how that we came together, because it's just another story. But it was from two threads that came together. And then the Ben Terrett one, in terms of the face for gov.uk, that's a nice story, I think, because of how it happened. And Ben Terrett's school children went to the same school as Amelia Noble, one of my students at the Royal College of Art from the design group called Kerr Noble. As a result, Ben said, do you know anybody that could sort of help us with the typography? And so she mentioned me, because she remembered me from the teaching. So Ben turned up here, just like this, had coffee, and he told me all about what they were doing at gov.uk, because it was all a big idea, big change, big this, big that, new this, all of that. So fascinating. And then he invited me to go to their place opposite Holborn, and amazing place. And there were about 100 of these people in this enormous studio working on the wall and that and everything. Just to talk, to be introduced to them and talk to the team about this and that, I'll show them that, this, all of that. And then I got some printouts of what they were doing, and again, to cut a long story short, they were using Gil Georgia, they were all web fonts, Gil Georgia, and I think another face as well. Well, obviously that's too many faces, lots of colours, lots of coding, photographs, this and that. You can imagine it.
I
but much better than any website, other government websites. Mm. And they were sort of trying design programs that people could phone, email in and say,
yeah,
you know.
Testing them.
Testing. So it was really a very innovative way of designing, because they immediately would get a response and they'd do something about it.
Mm.
So anyway, I just sort of looked at these faces and I said, well, I'm working on a digital version of Transport with Henrik Kubel of A2. And I may have suggested, and then before I finished, he said, well, we thought of Transport, but it's not a web font. So I just let that. I didn't want to. I never liked to push anything anyway. But they had thought of it. It was enough that they thought of it. So perhaps a few months passed or something, nothing. Then he came back again and showed me what they were doing. The message hadn't dropped. And I said, look, you've got to start with the questions, the writing. But anyway, and I gave him a typography lesson right from scratch. I said, scrap it all, start from the beginning, and reduce it a minimalist number of parts, and certainly with typeface. You only want one typeface. You don't want, I said, it's got to be clear. Nobody wants to be, you're not selling anything. You want to find out what a new license costs or your income tax or something. You want it immediately. So all of that was completely taken on board. And they actually, the woman who did all that writing won a DNAD black pencils. Didn't win anything for the design, but it did win a design museum award. Then I think I was on holiday then. I started email, keeping in contact. And then they wanted to do it in Transport. By then we'd moved on, Henrik and I, in terms of designing it in several ways as a typeface and as a web font, which is a technique much more further on down the line. So it was all there. And then Henrik did a special version for gov.uk in two ways. So that's how that happened.
Well, that's very good. And it seems highly appropriate when you consider that the motorway signs were part of a bigger government initiative. So it's back home.
It's come back full circle. So that was satisfying.
Over the years, there have not really been, still a very male-dominated scene, the world of design.
Mm. By so that I mean, so I'm told.
Sadly, it is. I mean, it's there's a high volume of women, always has been, but they, you know, and I've worked, you know, for 30 years. During that time, I employed, you know, lots of
women,
but sadly, they always drifted away. Got married, had kids, and never got back on the merry-go-round. Mm. You know, some do. Illustrators can do it. And I think the digital age has made it a little better. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you about your, because you've been in the world of graphic design for such a long time. Did you ever have issues in that world? I mean...
I think I'll pass on that one.
Well, it's... Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking...
I think the thing... Well, look, it was Frith Kerr was asked that question at the AGI Congress at the Barbican in 2013, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And her answer was, I would rather talk about my work than my gender. I thought that's so good.
Yes, I'm not suggesting for one moment that it's not about gender, but I do feel that it's still difficult
women.
I do feel that it's difficult, and
yes.
I just wondered whether you had a view on it.
I do. I do have very strong views on it. In a way, except whenever I am asked to do a book on graphic design that's all to do with women, I will never go down that path, never ever. You are who you are, where you are, because of your work. Gender must not come into it at all. And of course I've hit the glass ceiling several times, but that's how it goes. And I've been so lucky in terms of the people I've worked with. Jock Kinnear, for one. I mean, my champions have all been men, and some women students from the college who know me for my work and also for our friendship that have always continued after the college. So you see, I see these brilliant women who, I can talk about Frith from Kernobyl because they get married, and that, of course, it's natural, it happens, and they have children. Now, it's a lot easier now for them because some of them are earning more than their husbands, and they pay, they have to juggle with schooling. You've been there anyway. And they get carers and they get this and they get that, and that's where the money goes. But they don't give up on their work because they are committed to it, they're passionate about it. And so you do need that commitment that carry you have good times and bad times and thin times and all of that. And I've always had had to sort of think quite hard. I think if I think at the Royal College of Art, I would have been in my late 40s when there was a big change in terms of who ran the department, and Gert Dunbar came in then as the professor. But I got caught's not the right word, but everyone was almost being fired at that time to get new staff. And I had a phone call from the rector, Jocelyn Stevens, expecting to be, your time is up, because I'd been there a long time, and that's fair enough. But he just said, oh, Margaret, would you be prepared to run the department with Gert, who would have been a part-time professor, for a term before Liz McQuiston is free from Leicester to come and do the job, because Gert had appointed her. So I rang up Brian Tattersfield, and I said, what should I do, Brian? He said, well, take it, do it. So I thought, oh, God, no, that I'll be really into teaching then. But I did take it, and it was a fantastic time with some amazing students, wonderful jobs, mad, crazy with Gert and that and the rector, everyone being sacked, fired, bullied, this, but the work was really good.
I wanted to ask you...
And the rest is history.
Yes.
So I don't have to answer any more questions. I will say one thing, but it can be off the record.
Yes.
I would have made a rubbish mother because I would have fretted and worried my whole life.
Yes.
Would have been drawn into them and making it right for them.
Yes.
So in terms of the students, I like it to come right for them.
Yes.
So that gives me that's my reward. I have to go back here because my mother, she was really popular with the students at Pretoria High School. They called her Mrs. Cowell because she would give them everything, and she'd give us very little because she'd say their mothers weren't there, so she can't give us the affection that they don't get. Something like that. So
oh,
we
I
were.
See.
So there's something hitting. There's something there right back that
understand.
I that explains why I'm who I am.
I'm interested. This is okay. I'll get to this question. Simple question.
I shan't sleep tonight.
Who do you design for?
I love answering that question. Myself. Actually, but I want the person I'm designing it for to be absolutely delighted with what I'm doing. And that's my reward if they are.
Well, that's interesting because, what I was going to say is that it seems to me, this is not about you, I concur with what you're saying, and I think that your work, when I look at it and when I read about it and hear things you've said, your work has to have a purpose.
Oh, yes.
It's got to have a purpose.
Absolutely.
And it's got to function well. Yes. That seems to me to be paramount. Yes. It seems to me a lot of designers these days are designing for other designers, primarily.
How do you mean?
Well, they are not interested in doing what you've just said, hoping that the client will like it, and that's an added benefit. Designers are designing for other designers, if you like, to say, aren't I great? I've just done this. There's a lot of this. It's like a little designers showing off to one another.
Yeah.
And I don't see any... I see a lot of decorative work, is what I'm saying.
Oh, right. I've never been of that.
No, I mean, I think your work has a functionality.
Yes, it's got to have an idea. I don't mean in the you know, current easy sense of it as ideas against decoration.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got to be answering a specific question. And, you know, if something... Always if client... I've almost got bored with the word client, but it's... And it's not a trick, but in order to answer it in your way, you almost have to rephrase it. So, in other words, you reshape the brief, because the brief could be all up the wrong. So once you've shaped that in a more interesting approach in terms of a question, it opens the door for so many possibilities in terms of answers.
Mm.
So it lets you in.
Yeah. Well, briefs are a starting point, aren't they? Always.
Yes.
You know,
somebody wants something, they're going to give you
some
money for it.
They say, this is what we think the problem is. What do you think?
Yes. I mean, you see, I've stopped all of that kind of work now.
Yeah.
I'm working on... Well, I do get invited to... Well, my talk, actually, to actually get my talk across, I split it up into... I called it work and play. And very simply, work is what you get paid for. Play is what you get invited to do. I mean, you get invited to do similar things to me, and they're quite fun, so you do them.
Mm.
But no one's paying you.
Mm.
But also, nobody can say, you can't do that. Or, so I jolly well do it.
Or make the type bigger.
I've got lots of those stories. No, absolutely. I'm making the type bigger...
Well, that's the
one job for the National Trust that I did with students after they graduated, and they were promotional posters for the National Trust, and there was this one advertising guy who came in, and it was the first thing I like to say. Everyone likes to have something to criticise, so it was the size of the type. The students were fuming, and I was fuming too, but I had to keep quiet. So I just said quite quietly, "Well, we'll look at it again." So we went away. We made it smaller, and we came back, and he said, "Great." So that's it.
That's good.
That's how you win.
Well, tell me, what is exciting you at the moment? I mean, is there something you'd love to get your teeth into?
Well, right.
Because there's always that, you know, I'd love to...
No, because what I'm doing is what I'm doing. I don't know.
Well, what are you doing anyway? What are you doing at the moment that's exciting you that you're...
You see, the thing about type design, it's almost become fashion. Everybody's doing it. It's the now thing to do. Students are doing typefaces, and you can almost see the new ones creeping in on channel, on BBC and that. With a little, we'll drop that, we'll do that, with that, and sort of it looks different. So it's almost fashion. And they're always digitally conceived, because that's the nature of technology. And I come from a hand drawing. That's my basis of getting in, is to sort of slow things down. So one of the faces that I showed in terms of play and my own work, which also came from a real job, which was a cookbook, artist cookbook, published by the magazine Baseline.
Mm.
So I did a spaghetti cross one, right? Okay. So I started playing with pasta, like you do with fiddlesticks. And I was thinking that the wonderful thing about adding different weights, instead of going for, you know, the five or the six weights, all you have to do, the alphabet is structurally very simple. A child can draw it in a minute, the skeleton of it. But it's actually how you flesh it out with ideas and interpretations. So with the pasta, I mean, I had a wonderful week. I'm halfway there with it here. So it was one I showed right at the end, because the starting point is not drawing, it's physical. I've spent ages sorting out packets of spaghetti because they're not all the right length. And then you can break them in modular parts And then it becomes three-dimensional. And then to actually make the weight of each letter, you just add another stick of pasta, don't you? So, you know, an A's can be... So it's another way of playing.
Mm.
And so what I've got into now that is wonderful is I've eventually bought an iPhone 6, not the big model. And the camera, now I've got used to how to keep it steady. It's wonderful.
Really,
I've also got a little Canon camera that I do. I will never use a tripod. It's too long to set up. I just have to catch my thinking either on a drawing scribble or what. And then I photograph various stages. That's my way of working. So, of course, on this table, I was doing very quickly a whole sequence of alphabets, weights, this. Then Henrik comes along because we meet up quite a lot. And because he helped me put together my presentation with DNAD. Then he brings his computer along and we, from the messing about with the pasta, straight on screen, and then we can reverse it, white out of black, and then that can become a digital typeface. But you've come in on it from a new starting point. Mm. So I then said, you get carried away a bit when you're doing a talk. I said, I'm really looking forward to doing the italic, because you can't do an italic with straight bits. Because I said, you'd have to cook it then, and then you sling it at the wall, and then you can just nudge it into shape. Well, you see, that sounds stupid, doesn't it? And
I like the connection between pasta, spaghetti, and the word italic. Italic.
Oh, right, yes.
You've got that Italianesque.
I called it alpha pasta.
Alpha pasta.
I called it antipasta to begin with, because in the book it's against eating pasta because it makes you fat.
Hmm.
So that was why I did the cross against... Well, you might not have read the text, but...
I think I did.
Anyway, but alpha pasta, I thought, sounds nice. But also, so you see, one plays.
Yeah.
This is my play, but it has to start with an idea.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm working on. And the other one is where I'm going next.
Oh, good.
This is with... That. Also, it's connected with road signs. Everything comes round to road signs. But I was asked in 2008 by Humphrey Ocean, who was curating a room at the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, and he thought my drawing of the roadworks man, he liked that. It was a different kind of drawing, and he used to go and give lectures on drawing. So he asked me if I would like to do something, painting, anything for this room. So he came and spoke, and so I did. I took a road sign and I painted it out, and I did me, as a pictogram of me sort of thing. So I called it a self-portrait. So anyway, as a result of that, that's now being sold as a cliche print, but now doing a full-sized screen print of it. So it's 34 inches across the base, and that's what I'm working on now. So I'm just, that's where I'm going.
Oh, well, that's...
And I'm working on one that you've been working on too, but we perhaps better not talk forward this, celebrating 50 years of the British road sign. And that's what I'm actually working on at the moment. And a series of personal postcards, which is another project that screen printed. Mm. So, I mean, there are several ideas jiggling. Well, always are several in my head.
You sound very busy.
But I have to not get too excited, because I'll just pass out. It's
well,
true.
We're coming to the end now.
Good.
Over the years as a teacher, even though you don't like to think of yourself as a teacher, but
yes.
you've obviously... You've given, I would assume, a lot of advice to a lot of young designers over the years.
Well, it's a two-way process. Yeah. Well, you know that, because you've read that.
I just want
thingy that Adrian Shaun.
I always like to end by asking whether you've got just one little gem of advice you would leave with us for a budding young Margaret Calvert out there somewhere who thinks, "Wow, I'd love to be a graphic designer
right.
and become as famous as Margaret Calvert." What sort of advice would you give them?
Never think of being famous. Never think of that as a goal. It has to have an enjoyment factor. You've got to enjoy what you're doing. You've got to enjoy the challenge. There's got to be a commitment there. It's not all fun, happiness, jolly. It's just not. But the interesting thing is, it is a people thing, and we forget that whatever the product is, for want of a better word. Whether it And it, with me and with road sign, it asks for a visit to the factory and to actually talk to people making something and what they're getting out, what they're doing. You know, it's fascinating. Mm. But I can't give one word of advice.
Okay. Well, look, Margaret.
I mean, I'll students at the college, if you ask them that question, they'd answered it very quickly. Rich and famous.
Yes.
That's all.
That's Well, look, I sort of will be seeing you on my journey back home to Dorset tomorrow, mostly via the M3 and the M27.
Don't say me. And you'll see there's so much the trouble with the roads. There's so much rubbish. You see, Jock and I, past 65, because if you actually put the 50, because of this year being the celebrating 50 years of the British road signs, it actually does work if you work it back, because it works from when it became law.
Oh, okay.
An Act of Parliament, and that was, I think, January or something, whatever, you'll work the sum out. Mm. So that's how they got that. But you see so much rubbish, so much this, and I'm sort of credited with doing the elderly people crossing sign. I mean, we've sort of all been pulled, you've done that too, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I did a rather, I mean, I've subverted the whole thing and had a Zimmer frame with a big
pool
of blood.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, no one's going to stop you.
No.
No, yes. And I actually came up with what I did anyway with Marion Duchamp.
That's right.
When my sister had a heart attack.
Oh.
So she actually drew it and did it, the idea.
Oh, I see.
Which we all had together.
Yeah.
So I just thought we have to put something in so that people don't think I've designed the elderly people crossing one, which actually looks, it does the job.
It does.
And quite frankly, all the ones that we did were just for laughs. So the project has defeated itself.
Yes. The fact is that project, the road sign project, mm-hmm. has transcended time and style. They work. They're in people's minds. I don't feel offended. You know, I'm 71. I don't feel offended by looking at two.
You're slipping a lad.
Well, I don't feel offended by seeing two slightly hunched over. I think it's rather charming.
Because you also think they're older than you, don't you?
Yeah, of course you do.
And they're really,
you think
designed
they're really
to be
old.
Outside. Yes, yeah. And actually, I have seen some like that. Really, really old.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Well, we'll end it there, Margaret Calvert.
Yes, less
thank
is
you
more.
Very much.
I would say less is more.
Okay.
That's a good thing to
less
say.
Less is more.
Less is more. Work that out for yourself. Yeah.